Hello?
Hello?
Yep.
Okay.
All right. I slept all day yesterday. Like, all day. I mean, I did a lot of cleaning, but I took multiple naps, which is not very me.
No, that's not you at all. I had a couple jobs, so I was driving from Pennsylvania to Sykesville.
No.
I felt awful. We had like family, big family party this weekend, and we were all just exhausted.
Because the last people left my house after 1 o'clock. So.
And yeah, so we were all just exhausted, but I did treat myself to a Coke slushie.
That's really kind of you.
It was really great.
What a gift. What a gift to your soul.
I had that and a Taco Bell chicken quesadilla.
We went to Taco Bell.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the girls asked for. They were like, we really need Taco Bell. And yeah. I was like, you know what? We do need Taco Bell.
We do.
That's exactly right.
But yeah, that's really my perfect hangover food is like I go to McDonald's or Burger King and I get a fountain soda, like a Coke, and I get fries. That's my favorite.
That's what I wanted.
Yep.
But everybody else voted Taco Bell. I wanted fries and a Coca-Cola, yep. McDonald's Coke.
That's
but
my favorite combo.
I ended up being okay with it because I actually wasn't that hungover. I was just tired.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That was mine too. Like, yeah. I was just exhausted. But we're here now for more drinks.
I can hang, baby. Here I am.
Because this is history.
On the rocks.
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we're not historians.
No, absolutely not.
We Google and podcast, and I watched a documentary this time, a PBS documentary, no less.
I tried. My documentary wasn't available. You had to get it on DVD.
No, thank you. No, thank
you. Can you believe that?
Scratches on it exclusively.
And I'm kind of irritated because, like, I know there's so much more to my person, and
sure.
I could not find, like, there was just like not like, I know there's a lot more, and I was kind of frustrated. So anyways, but that's what we're here to do. But we do know that you are busy.
So busy.
You're digging up your tulip bulbs maybe, and because you're like, all right, I gotta get them ready for next year.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if that's how, I've never planted tulip bulbs, so I don't know how they work.
Tulips you can leave in zone 7B, but okay. There are certain things you can't leave.
Oh, okay.
Because it's too cold.
Yeah.
Or you have to put an extra layer of mulch on them at the end of the year.
Oh.
Like my canna lilies, those red lilies outside, I have to like pile on.
Oh,
keep
right.
them warm. It's like a blanket of dirt.
Well, there you go. Maybe you're doing that. but we know you're too busy to look up what these women look like, so we're going to describe them for you. We're going to get a little
physical.
Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I'm doing Ida Lewis. She's a Victorian white woman from Rhode Island. She wore traditional black and white clothing, although her job was anything but traditional for a woman. She had brown hair that she always wore tied back. She was rather petite. Think I just swallowed a bug. and she, you know, she was quite lovely but tough looking.
Mm.
And there's a lot of drawings of her because she was like an object that people wanted to put on the front of newspapers. She was quite famous in her day.
Okay.
Quite famous. Who are you doing and what does she look like?
I am doing Bella Abzug, and she has a very iconic look. The most important thing is that she quite literally always wore a hat, and not just any hat, but a floppy hat. We'll get into why in the story. She has curly brown hair that is typically cropped short. She has a round face and very like thin eyes that look like they have a lot of dark eyeliner. And she has small square teeth. Like those are like the iconic parts of her look.
Cute.
And other than that, she was just a woman yelling into microphones in the 70s.
Great.
And we love her for it.
Great.
All right. Do you want to know what you're about to drink?
I really do.
This is called A Woman's Place. This is a sangria. So in the sangria, you mix red wine, maraschino cherries. I use like some of those like darker ones, you know, like the bourbon kind of cherries, and I put a little bit of the juice in as well.
Sure.
Elderflower liqueur, spiced rum, rosemary, and lemon slices, and you let that all sit for a while, and then you top it with sparkling water before you serve it.
Cheers. This is so good.
Mm. Yeah, that's nice.
I love a sangria.
Mm-hmm.
I love a sangria with sparkling anything.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh,
I think
nice.
You really need the sparkling water on top. We use the lemon sparkling water, and it just like softens the whole thing.
It does.
It's nice. All right. Well, what do you know about Bella Abzug?
So I can picture her exactly mm-hmm. when you explain her with her hat, right? Mm-hmm. So because of the era and because I always picture her like speaking, I'm going to assume that she's like rowling up slash leading crowds into second wave feminism.
For sure.
Okay. That's exactly my background. That's all I know about her era. Like I can picture.
Yep. You can picture her. Yeah. So because again, I couldn't get the documentary. I got most of this from Wikipedia, and there was an interview with her daughter, Liz, on the podcast, Our Mothers Ourselves, which was really insightful. So let's get into it. Bella Savitsky was born on July 24th, 1920 in New York City. Both of her parents were Yiddish-speaking Jewish immigrants from Cherniv in the Russian Empire, which is now a part of Ukraine. Her mother, Esther, was a homemaker who immigrated in 1902, and her father, Emmanuel, was a butcher who immigrated in 1906. He ran a meat market called Live and Let Live, which I love, and that was on 9th Avenue. And Bella worked there, running the register when she was a young girl. From an early age, Bella was known to be loud, opinionated, and competitive, much to the chagrin of all the kids in her neighborhood who were tired of losing to her. But she said it was actually her religious upbringing that had the most to do with her future feminism. Hmm.
I wonder, too, if that's what why the name of the meat market is what it is. Like,
what do you mean?
So, like, you know how Jewish people who eat kosher, they separate their meat from their dairy. Mm-hmm. And it's like we separate our meat from the source of life. So like,
yeah, that's true.
Live and let live, like yeah. Eat the meat, but also like let the animals prosper successfully. Yeah,
that could definitely be it for sure. But according to Bella, it was during these visits to the synagogue that I think I had my first thoughts as a feminist rebel. I didn't like the fact that women were consigned to the back rows of the balcony.
Preach.
Mm-hmm. So when Bella was just 13 years old, her father suddenly passed away. And this led to another internal feminist conflict with her and her faith. Her Orthodox synagogue did not permit women to say the mourner's Kaddish, since that rite was reserved for the sons of the deceased. Her father didn't have any sons, so Bella went to the synagogue every morning for a year to say the mourner's Kaddish for her father brazenly defying the rules of her own synagogue. Throughout her high school years at Walton High in the Bronx, Bella was very active in the student government, even serving as class president. She also, during this time, took violin lessons, and she attended Florence Marshall Hebrew School. She went on to major in political science at Hunter College of the City University of New York and simultaneously attended the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. At Hunter College, she was student council president, and she was very active in the student union. She wanted to become a lawyer, so she applied to the best law school, Harvard Law. They said, "We don't accept women." So she went to Columbia instead, graduating with her law degree in 1944.
We've had several people who ended up at Columbia because Harvard said no.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I find it fascinating that people that are very religious and into theology are often into law and feminism.
Yes.
And I wonder if there is some of that, you know, that famous quote, like, I learned rebellion while I was on my knees praying, or like something like that. I think there's so much patriarchal nonsense in religion that most people are like, this shouldn't be here.
Right.
Like, this is through the wrong lens.
Well, and I think, too, it's kind of like a similar way to how I feel about it is like, the more you learn about it, the more frustrated you get that there are people that take advantage of it, and there are people that distort it. Like, this thing that has this potential to save people's lives, you know, like that means so much to families and keeps people together. It literally creates community. And then you have people who use it as this tool to separate people and to make people feel bad. And I hate it because that's not the purpose. It drives me crazy.
Right.
And I think that there is that thing of like, it's supposed to be this thing that gives us order and justness and fairness
and hope and comfort. Hope,
and people just distort it and they use it to pursue their evil whims. And it is maddening. And I think that that's why, you know, Bella was like, well, I'm going to study the whole thing so I can also speak intelligently on it when people try and come at me.
All right, Katie, get to some churches, flip some tables, go out to the narthexes, be like, excuse me, money changers.
I wish
churches had money for us to flip.
When I found out that the person running like the White House faith office, she was literally selling prayers this Easter. She was selling prayers that also, like, I guess to, like, make it less bad, like, came with crystal crosses for $1,000. you could buy a crystal cross and prayers, which is like, you're not supposed to be buying prayers.
That's what people did in the Middle Ages. That's how trick-or-treating started. They would go from door to door and like beg for money. Like, I'll pray for your family members in purgatory if you pay me, like, as a beggar. What?
It's so messed up.
I'm so sorry to get us so off track. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. So she graduates with a law degree, 1944. And that's the same year she marries her husband, Martin Abzug. He was a novelist and a stockbroker. The two met on a bus in Miami. They were headed to the same, like, classic music concert.
Cute.
They remained married until his death in 1986. Your birth.
Oh, my gosh.
Year, whatever.
Perfect.
Year of birth. Is that...
Yeah, 1986, my birth year.
Birth year, that's
what I'm trying to learn. Or your birth, either way, it's fine.
He was truly the love of her life, and he supported her in everything that she did. They had two daughters, and that's really all there was in her personal life. So from here on out, it's all business.
Because that's what, you know what they say, two daughters, happiest families.
Really?
Yeah, birth order. That's what, like...
Really?
I read this whole article online, two daughters, and I mean, that it's one article. Mm-hmm. Because, like, but I think they had to be in a certain age range, because I think I mentioned that to Linda one time, and she was like, no.
Oh, that's right. She only has a sister. Two. Wow. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's a situation, so...
That's so interesting. Uh-huh. Well, the year after, in 1945, she was officially admitted to the New York bar at a time when there were not that many women practicing law. One number I heard is only 2% of bar members were women at this time. So she was one of them. Her specialty at the firm, Pressman, Witt & Kammer, was labor rights, tenants' rights, and civil liberties cases.
Hell yeah.
And one of her early prominent cases was an appeals court for a man named Willie McGee. He was a black man from Louisiana who was convicted of raping a white woman who he had been in a consensual relationship with. He was sentenced to death by an all-white jury after they deliberated for 2.5 minutes. The case drew national attention, with many famous people, including Josephine Baker, denouncing the sentence, saying that he was not given a fair trial. There was no evidence, like no concrete evidence. So people were really up in arms about this. So Bella was called in to appeal the conviction. They needed someone who wasn't from the area because the local lawyers who had been working on the case were basically forced to stop. They and their families were receiving death threats and constant harassments. And so for the safety of them and their families, they had to step away. But if the Southern men weren't safe, a Jewish woman from New York certainly was not.
No way.
Every time Bella came to town, the white business owners refused to serve her anywhere, often including the local restaurants and hotels. Once she went down and she was forced to stay overnight in a truck stop restroom, literally in the stall, just trying to like stay up. And it was just like every time she went down there, it was absolute hell. And this was 4 years of her life that she spent traveling to and from Louisiana for this case. And she argued it all the way up to the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, she lost the case and Willie was executed on May 8th, 1951. And Bella would suffer great personal loss because of this case. Bella had been pregnant while working on the case and she ended up losing her baby at 8 months. And the doctor said it was due to extreme stress. Which is absolutely awful.
I feel like there's so many wrong things happening in just the last second of what... I mean, I think that's the thing that people use to scare women away from working when they're pregnant and postpartum. But also, like, it's an actual thing that can happen.
Yeah.
Like, you can lose a baby when you're in your third trimester.
Yeah. And it's like... And the annoying thing is, too, is that it was directly, like, the action of, like... these people who would probably consider themselves like very pro-life, you know, and it's like you're harassing a 8-month pregnant woman to the point where she miscarries. Mm-hmm. Like you're making her life absolute hell. Like how is that pro-life?
Right.
It's so frustrating. Everything about this case was devastating, but it really changed her in a profound way. Bella desperately wanted to keep fighting on behalf of people who were being left behind in society. During the McCarthy era, she was one of the few legal attorneys willing to openly combat the House Un-American Activities Committee. This, of course, was the committee responsible for fighting all the communists in the U.S., which ended up just being the committee that targeted people who in any way were different, especially left-leaning celebrities, LGBTQ people. And she defended many big-name people, including at one point Albert Einstein, who they had targeted. She was an outspoken advocate of liberal causes, including the Equal Rights Amendment, and she opposed the Vietnam War as well as the military draft. She was an early participant in Women's Strike for Peace, and her political stance placed her on the master list of Nixon's political opponents. And she was labeled, like so many great women were, potentially dangerous. And she was surveilled by the FBI.
We met one of them.
We did.
America's Most Dangerous Women.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's funny, though? I'm shocked I don't know more about her with how high in law she was. Like, if she was arguing cases up to the Supreme Court, like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, RBG was doing.
Well, and she's about to get, like, she's about to get even more involved and higher up. It's crazy. So after circling the political sphere for so long, Bella decided it was time to get directly involved. In 1970, she challenged the 14-year incumbent Leonard Farbstein in the Democratic primary for a congressional district.
So she's trying to get into political government. Law.
Yes.
Okay.
This is on Manhattan's West Side. She quickly, in her campaign, gained the nickname Battling Bella. And her very first campaign slogan would be one for the ages. This woman's place is in the House of Representatives.
She coined that. And that's like what we just used. Yesterday was May the 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's the big, they put it on all the Star Wars shirts. Mm-hmm. This woman's place is in the rebellion.
Yep. 100%.
Referring to General Leia, of course.
She defeated Farbstein in a considerable upset and then defeated talk show host Barry Farber in the general election. During her first term in Congress in 1971, she joined other leading feminists such as Gloria Steinem, Shirley Chisholm, and Betty Friedan to found the National Women's Political Caucus.
All three are alum of the show.
Mm-hmm. And together they fought for the Equal Rights Amendment. Unfortunately, her district was eliminated when they were redistricting, so she had to run again, this time against William Fitz Ryan. He beat Bella in the primary, but then he died before the general election. His wife, Priscilla, took on his ticket, but at the Democratic convention, they were like, let's go with Bella.
No, she has
a lot more experience.
No, thank you.
Sorry, Priscilla. Not that you're not great, but...
Yeah. We love you, but...
Yeah. she won easily and was officially back in the House in 1974. She was one of the first members of Congress to support gay rights, introducing the first federal gay rights bill known as the Equality Act of 1974 with fellow Democratic New York City Representative Ed Koch, who later became mayor of New York and was featured on an episode of Sex and the City.
Pretty brave in the 70s, I feel like,
really
to
brave.
Be promoting gay rights in Congress.
Yes, 100%.
That could lose your whole voter base very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure did for a lot of politicians.
Yeah.
Like, they voted yes on this.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, she got there also after, like, opposing Vietnam and stuff. She's, like, pretty left-leaning.
Yes.
Very left-leaning.
Oh, very left-leaning.
Yeah.
She also chaired historic hearings on government secrecy, being the chair for the Subcommittee on Government Information and Individual Rights. She was the sponsor for the Equality Credit Opportunity Act. This is the act that made it unlawful to discriminate against any applicant with respect to any aspect of credit transaction on the base of race, color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, or age. So the reason that single women can get credit cards in their own name is because of Bella and this bill.
And that is a fact brought up every Women's History Month.
Yes.
Like, did you know that, like, when your mom was born, or at least for us, when our moms were born, they would not have been able to have credit cards unless they were co-signed by their dad or their husband.
I mean, when my mom was, like, a young adult. Like,
yes, yeah, this is the 70s, yeah.
The 70s.
I just, like, I think about that so much because for me, I wasn't born into that world. Like, when I talk to Caroline and Eliza, or, like, specifically Caroline, I'm like, do you know when you were born, gay people couldn't get married?
Yeah, it
like,
feels insane.
Like, I feel like this is
them.
That.
Yeah.
This is, like, that thing.
Yes, it
of
is.
Of course, also, gay people couldn't get married in the 70s either.
Oh,
but, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She was a co-sponsor of HR 13157. This established the Clara Barton National Historic Site, which, as we know from last season, was the first national park site dedicated to the achievements of a woman. And we know that she was quite a spitfire to work with. You don't get this much done without being crazy.
Mm.
She became famous for verbally attacking people, including referring to journalist Doug Ireland as a fat cocksucker.
Ooh.
Like, on the floor, I think.
I mean, people love to just...
Yeah,
mudsling now, so
yeah.
Whatever.
She was also the first person to openly call for Nixon's impeachment over the Vietnam War. And even though she could sometimes be rather passionate, she was also known as a peacekeeper and someone very adept at bringing people together, even across the aisle, which is again, like how far away from that we've come, that like she is so left leaning. She's involved in so many, like what especially would be at the time, radical politics. And she's bringing people together.
I also like, I see it in like, you know, if you disagree with another politician and they're on the right and you're like, you are a fat cocksucker, that's one thing to like, yeah, not like someone, but also then being willing to work on a bill, yes, with someone and not be like, oh, everybody on the right or everybody, mm-hmm, on the left is like this,
right?
And that is the only news that's being stuffed down our throats.
Yep. Anyways,
Katie, do you need any more stress this week in your personal life?
No, I don't.
Do you want any more?
I do not.
I'm piling it up for you.
She's famous for bringing people together. She was always famous, as we said, for her hats, in the physical. But hats were not allowed on the house floor. And whenever she was forced to remove her hat, she said she felt naked and unrecognizable. Mm. So I don't know if they made her remove it all the time. I think sometimes they let her slip. But
her hats remind me of the ones that Rosemary Kennedy would wear.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Like the very small, like floppy.
Yeah, but like, and like that's the thing. The brim would widen or get smaller. Like, mm, you know, there were a lot of brims, but it was always like a little floppy. Mm-hmm. Apparently the origin story of the hat is that she started wearing them during her law career, mm, because every time she went into the meeting, the men in the room would assume that she was a secretary. She'd be like, hi, I'm Bella Abzug. I'm from this, you know, law firm. And they'd be like, that's great. Can you get us some coffee while we wait for the lawyer? She's like, I am the lawyer.
It's me.
It's
hi,
me.
I'm the lawyer. It's me.
Sick of this assumption, her husband said, maybe you should start wearing a hat and gloves and, you know, something to say, I'm a professional. And he goes, no secretary is going to be wearing a hat and gloves at the office. And so she did. And the hats continued. But she said, you know, she used to say, you know, but when I got into the government, the gloves came off.
Oh!
Which is very funny because I first thought that the hats were a religious thing because she was a Jewish woman.
Right.
And she was also, speaking of her, you know, being a proud Jewish woman, she was also an open Zionist. She was a member of the Socialist Zionist Youth Movement when she was younger. And in 1975, she challenged the UN General Assembly when they determined that Zionism was a form of racism and racial discrimination. She disagreed, saying that she felt it was a liberation movement. So, you know, it's just something I felt like I had to include in the story just because it is a very polarizing topic. And I like people to have all the information.
Give it to us.
Yes. In February 1975, she was a part of a bipartisan delegation sent to Saigon by President Gerald Ford,
wow,
to assess the situation, mm-hmm, on the ground in South Vietnam near the end of the Vietnam War. She had quite an intense political career for those few years. She really earned her nickname Battling Bella because she just didn't stop. But her official political career did eventually come to an end in 1976 when she lost her nomination by less than 1% to the more moderate Daniel Patrick Moynihan. She never held elected office again after leaving the House, although she remained a high-profile figure and was again a candidate on multiple occasions. And so during this time period, that race that she lost, she was running for the Senate. So she, I think, was trying to like move into
up.
That. Yeah.
A little more fancy.
Mm-hmm. So after her Senate loss in 1977, she ran for mayor of New York, but was unsuccessful. She also ran twice more for the House, but lost both times. Mm. In early 1977, President Jimmy Carter commissioned the National Commission on the Observance of International Women's Year and appointed Bella to head it. The commission was tasked with encouraging cooperative activity in the field of women's rights and responsibilities. And this was in conjunction with the International Women's Year, which had been declared by the United Nations in 1972. Numerous events were held over the next 2 years, culminating in the 1977 National Women's Conference in November. And she would continue this work as one of the two co-chairpersons for the National Advisory Committee for Women until her dismissal in January 1979. And this apparently was not a mutual dismissal. They rarely are. And this caused a point of tension between many prominent feminists and President Carter. They did not like that he removed Bella from this position. And I don't know why he did. Maybe it was in the documentary. She founded and ran.
Documentary. Send us a digital copy. We don't Please. Want your DVD.
She founded and ran several women's advocacy organizations. She founded a grassroots organization called Women USA and continued to lead feminist advocacy events. For example, serving as the Grand Marshal of the Women's Equality Day in New York March on August 26, 1980. In the early 90s, she co-founded the Women's Environment and Development Organization, which was, in their own words, a global women's advocacy organization working towards a just world that promotes and protects human rights, gender equality, and the integrity of the environment. In 1991, this organization, which is usually referred to as WeDo, they held the World's Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in Miami, where 1,500 women from 83 countries produced the Women's Action Agenda 21. And at the UN, she developed the Women's Caucus, which analyzed documents, proposed gender-sensitive policies and language, and lobbied to advance the women's agenda for the 21st century. And this was at the 1992 UN Conference on the Environment Development in Rio de Janeiro. And they were talking about a lot of different women's issues at, you know, plenty of other events, including the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. So she's doing a lot, and she is known as a really early advocate on what is now known as ecofeminism. So basically, like, all the things that I just kind of listed off were her efforts to be like, women should care about the environment because us destroying the environment is hurting women specifically. And it's her, like, this is a feminist issue is what she was kind of proposing in her work. Bella was not slowing down in her work, but her body desperately needed her to. She was eventually using a wheelchair at times to help with mobility because she had been fighting breast cancer for a few years.
Oh, no.
And she had unfortunately started to develop heart disease as well. In March of 1998, she gave a speech to the UN, and shortly after the speech, she was taken to the hospital, where the doctor told her that she had to have open-heart surgery. She said, "Maybe later, I don't have time." And he said, "You have to get this done now, or you will die." She had the surgery, but still, unfortunately, ended up passing away on March 31st, 1998, from complications following the surgery. She was 77 years old.
So young.
So young.
And after doing so much.
Mm-hmm. Bella was honored a lot in her lifetime and after. In 1991, she received the Maggie Award from Planned Parenthood. This is the highest honor they give out, of course, which is named after Margaret Sanger, their founder. She also received the highest honor at the UN, the Blue Beret Peacekeepers Award. In 1994, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. That same year, she received a medal from the Veteran Feminists of America. In 2004, her daughter Liz, an adjunct urban studies professor, Barnard College, and political consultant, founded the Bella Abzug Leadership Institute to mentor and train high school and college women to become effective leaders in civic, political, corporate, and community life. In 2017, Time Magazine named Bella Abzug one of its 50 women who made American political history. There are also lots of landmarks in New York City bearing her name. And Hudson Yards Park was recently renamed Bella Abzug Park in her honor. Harvey Fierstein played Bella. So if you don't know who Harvey Fierstein is, he was Robin Williams' hairdresser brother in Mrs. Doubtfire. And he played Bella in a play that he wrote about her life. And her daughter Liz helped produce the play. And they used many exact quotes of hers in the play. I got to listen to excerpts of it, and it was great. Margot Martindale played her beautifully in Mrs. America, a show about the fight for the ERA. And that same year, Bette Midler played her in the movie The Glorias. In 2023, the documentary about her life, simply titled Bella, came out. The film interviewed people such as Barbara Streisand, Shirley MacLaine, Hillary Clinton, Lily Tomlin, Nancy Pelosi, and Gloria Steinem, all about the impact that Bella had on them and the world. And again, I couldn't get it, but apparently it's good. And the trailer's good. But I will end on a quote of hers that I think, unfortunately, exactly defines the current administration. She once said, "The establishment is made up of little men very frightened." And that's Bella Abzug.
Wow, Bella.
She got a lot done in her time.
She got so much done. And that's one of the things that gives me so much quiet encouragement about feminism. I think it's so easy to look at the heavy hitters that are so, so famous, that mm-hmm. are the big, like, flashy, mm-hmm. like, headline people. And, like, I was just watching a thing about the women's U.S. soccer team. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, of course we talk about Hope Solo and mm-hmm. Megan Rapinoe, but like there are 20 girls on that yep. team, some that yep. sit on the bench the entire time mm-hmm. who have played their whole life.
Yep.
Bella is playing her whole life.
Exactly.
She is playing and she is fighting and she is out there. And just because she's not a household name doesn't mean she's not making credit cards legal for everybody. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that she's not going to world eco-feminist conferences. Like, there are so many amazing, powerful women. And just because they're not on magnets with the Biggie Smalls crown on doesn't mm-hmm. mean that they're not there.
Exactly. And I like that, like, as this, like, New York woman, she had this experience, this very traumatic experience, but like in the South, you know, and being like, I hate the people down here right now, but
terrible.
But this is also like, they need more access to things. Like the women down here need more access to things. So like, she is also fighting for them when you right. really think about it. Mm-hmm. Like the stuff that she did in her time was for all women. It was for so many people, you know, to live a better life and have more access, you know.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so I think she's cool. And like you said, I think she was just doing the hard work that you need to be really smart to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You gotta appreciate
be, you gotta be able to go to Columbia.
Yes.
Even if Harvard turns you down, you have to be able to go to Columbia.
Exactly.
And that was not my path.
No. All right. Ready for part two?
Yeah.
Okay. Part two.
Yay.
Another cocktail.
Another cocktail. Another lesser known woman, but equally as famous. In
ooh,
a weird
in
way.
In a weird way. Okay.
Do you want to know what you're drinking?
Yes, I do.
This is actually called The Bravest Woman in America.
Okay.
And I wanted it to be yellow, like a lighthouse. Mm-hmm. It is mint leaves, and they are kind of, I just broke them up in my hands and mm-hmm. put them in the drink and mixed them in with bourbon and lemon juice, simple syrup, and then again, any type of soda water that you want to put on it. Ginger ale
perfect.
Is what it's technically called for, but.
It's really good. It's like a whiskey sour,
mm-hmm.
but there's like, but it's not exactly like a sour mix.
Right,
so
there's
it's just
no
like,
sour mix.
Yeah, it's a little different. I like it. I like it a lot.
You could do a little less lemon if you want the mint to come through more, or mm-hmm. use a mint simple syrup.
Ooh, yeah, you could do that.
I think
too.
Would be really nice because mm-hmm. I pulled up a mint julep recipe because I was like, we don't do enough of that.
No, for sure.
And it
not.
Is very good. It is very good. Okay, what do you know about Ida Lewis?
I think you said she was a lighthouse keeper, mm-hmm. so that's all I know.
Cool. That's all I knew going into this, and I'm actually really excited because I did all the Wikipedia research, and I was like, okay, this is good.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the very end, they were like, oh, and there was this PBS documentary called America's Forgotten Heroine, and I found it on YouTube. Like, I had to, like, search. I had to go to the sources on the mm-hmm. Wikipedia mm-hmm. page to find this documentary, and I mm-hmm. finally found it because it didn't come up on my initial search on
okay.
YouTube, but it is free on YouTube if
okay.
you want to watch it.
Perfect.
So Ida was not just the most famous female lighthouse keeper to ever live, but probably the most famous lighthouse keeper celebrity
I can't name another
of all
one
time. Yeah. And she's considered one of the most famous women from the 1800s. And honestly, if somebody wanted to write a historical fiction about this woman, it would be a great novel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have not seen one, but I think this would be a treat
okay.
to read. Ida Lewis was born in Newport, Rhode Island on February 25th, 1842. She was named after her mother and the second of four children, although the documentary said five children, maybe one died in infancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I really relate to her because she's the oldest daughter, but the second child.
Okay.
And that is the life that I live in, and it leaves me pretty much in charge of the family. Even though the eldest child is a son.
It's a very unique position.
Yes.
You know, I'm the baby and
but
the only
also
girl,
the
which
oldest
is a
girl.
Very classic.
Only girl,
you know?
Though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I feel like it's a very classic position. Like, this is literally one that's like, it's the Ginny Weasley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very classic trope.
Right.
But yours is, I feel like, not acknowledged enough, you know.
The eldest daughter thing. TikTok is doing it.
Really?
The TikTok brings out like the eldest daughter in the family things all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, are you doing okay or are you an eldest daughter? Okay. So her father was Captain Lewis of the Revenue Marines, and he was transferred to the Lighthouse Service. Specifically, he was a cutter pilot that dealt with piracy in that region, which we know in the 1800s was huge. Our Dr. Jamie Goodall, who's been on our show multiple times, has written books about pirates all up and down the coast, if you want to read any from the different regions. When Ida was 12 years old, her dad retired as a captain due to health to become this lighthouse keeper. And he was the lighthouse keeper of Lime Rock Lighthouse on a small island of Lime Rock in Newport in 1854. This island was also named the Half Acre Rock because of its very small size.
Wow.
The family lived on a comfortable corner in Newport, though. They didn't live on the island yet. Each day, her dad would row out to the lighthouse at dusk and light the oil lamp or whatever. And then he would row back in the morning to extinguish it, which is really exhausting and dangerous work in like the harbor off of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Where the waters are choppy. They are cold. There are whales. Like there, it's scary.
And a ton of giant rocks.
100%. The family is, like I said, off base still. Ida's 12. At this time, she quickly becomes an important part of the lighthouse staff for her dad, because like I said, this is hard. She often went to the lighthouse with him. She taught herself how to swim. Nobody else in the family learned how to swim. Her dad taught her how to row, how to care for the light, how to, if somebody was in the water, how to rescue them by bringing them in over the stern of the boat instead of over the edge so it wouldn't flip. So she's learning how to haul grown men onto a rowboat as a 12-year-old. It's hard to go there twice a day. The weather is terrible. So her dad goes to the government and is like, can you build a house on this island? And they actually grant it because they need it, because this is a really busy port.
Yeah.
So they build the house and the family moves out there. This is 1857. So it's about 3 years after her dad's been doing this every day, twice a day.
Wow.
Her dad is making $557 a year, which is good money back then.
Okay. It's so hard like to think about that in my head.
$500 a year? I spent that at the grocery store last week. Literally. After the family had been there for less than 4 months living on the island, her dad suffers a stroke.
No.
And he is now living with a disability. She's 15.
Oh, my gosh.
But the family needs this money, and the family needs this job.
And the house.
And the house. So Ida takes on the responsibilities of the domestic duties of the house, of caring for her dad. Her mom is caring for her seriously ill siblings.
Okay.
Or one of her siblings is seriously ill. And her mom would help with lighthouse stuff every once in a while, but Ida was the one who was taught how to row. Ida was the one who was taught how to swim. It was like she was born to do this job. She would fill the lamp with oil at sundown. Midnight, she would trim the wick, she would polish the carbon off the reflectors, she would extinguish the light at dawn. Her brother would say that by this time she was better at rowing than any boy he'd ever seen, and especially the best swimmer in Newport.
Wow. I mean, because that's the thing. It's like, it's not just a light switch you're flipping on and off. This is a very intense process.
It is. I mean, I think later in life, she like has an alarm that wakes her up like every half hour on the hour to check the light.
Oh my gosh.
Crazy. Mm. Since Lime Rock was almost completely surrounded by water, I think during dry season, it was like a rocky peninsula.
Okay.
Almost completely surrounded by water, the only way to reach the mainland was by boat. Every day, she would row her younger siblings across the water so that they could go to school. And she would fetch supplies from town as they were needed. Her dad says he would watch out the window scared to death that he was letting his teenage daughter do this. And, like, there was nothing he could do about it.
Yeah.
Lifehouse Light Lighthouse life is not for everyone. You can get stuck out there for days and weeks. If there's a storm, if there's snow, if the lake is frozen, the water, the bay, it's loud, it's windy. And in storms like that, houses have been taken off of rocks by big waves. It is scary. Ida's first rescue came when she was 15 years old.
Oh my gosh.
On one evening, there's a boat and it capsized. It's some men, quote, boys, about her age, and they were messing around, and the boat flips. Her mom sees it from the window and yells for Ida. She rows out to them and gets them aboard one at a time, over the stern, and it's really hard to convince people to do this when they are freezing in the water, to not try to climb on from the edge.
I would never know.
No, I wouldn't either, to go from the front.
And now I'm going to use this information.
Yeah. When I am in the water,
someone's life.
When I am in the water with a rubber blow up raft from the plane that goes down, stern is it. There's no stern. They're circle.
I legitimately feel like that is, like, not that people find themselves on boats, but anything can happen.
Right.
And maybe someone will learn this and save someone's life.
My dad told me how to get back in a canoe from the water when I was a kid.
Really? How do you do that?
I mean, you have to, like, be in it and flip it at the same time.
Oh, really? Like, so you have to, like, get back up in it and then flip the whole thing?
Right.
Wow. I should probably know that I have kayaks.
But, I mean, it's one of those things that's, like, the creeks that we are kayaking in are relatively still and canoeing and stuff. You know, it's like I was in my grandmother's creek off the Chesapeake Bay. I wasn't in, like, whitewater rafting situations. Okay. So she rows the boys back to her house. One of them is almost dead from the cold. Mm. And as the story goes, one of them outlives her and is a pallbearer at her funeral.
No. Mm-hmm.
Because she becomes, like, such an iconic rescuer in this harbor.
That's incredible.
Yeah. In the 1800s, Newport is one of the busiest port cities in the country. And everyone saw this woman on this rock in her dress every day. She became skillful at handling the family's rowboat, and she had to respond to criticism. People saw her out there doing this, rowing back and forth, lighting it, saving men from the harbor. And they were like, this is unladylike. To which she said to the newspaper, none but a donkey would consider it unfeminine to save lives. Like, this is what we do. She was a regular rescuer, though. On February 24th, 1966, there were three drunk soldiers who stole a boat to get back to base because it was quicker to go by water than by land. The boat flips. She has to go and get them. And one of them, she can't get back on the boat, so she has to tie a rope to him and haul him the lighthouse. She's not a large woman. She is, like, 5'3". She's shorter than I am, and she's very unassuming. Then some Irish guys are helping to move sheep from one field to another. And these sheep belong to Mr. Belmont of Belmont Stakes. And the Irishmen are trying to move these sheep. One of the sheep wanders off and jumps in the water. And the Irishmen are like, oh, shit, we're going to lose our job. So they go in the water after the sheep and then they get lost. So she has to go into the waves to get the men, bring the men out, and then goes back and saves the sheep. A real Jesus. You know what I'm saying?
Oh my gosh.
You have to go after the one sheep that left the flock. So every single time she saw those Irish men in town, they'd take their hats off. They'd shake her hand. They were just, like, enamored with her. So by this point, she's 27 years old. Everybody knows she's doing this, but none of her records are on the record. They're not broadcast. No rescues yet. So one night she's running a cold and she asks her mom to check the lighthouse. Like, I'm so sorry. I just need to stay down here in the room and sleep. I hate to ask, but the waves are fierce and a boat overturns. But this isn't just normal soldiers. This is Sergeant James Adam and Private John McLaughlin. And they were just passing through Newport Harbor to get to Fort Adams, which is what those other soldiers were going to. There's a fort around there. And they were in a small boat that was guided by this 14-year-old boy who, like, knew his way through the harbor. But a snowstorm is churning. The boat flips and the two men cling to the boat, but the boy is lost. The 14-year-old dies in the icy water. Her mom again sees it. She, without putting on a coat, without putting on shoes, remember, she's got a cold, she's laying in bed sick, rows out to them in these terrible waves, gets them in the boat. They're, like, dying, of exposure as she's trying to like bring them back to shore. Mm. And one of the soldiers said on the record, because they had to put it on the record because it was military and the boy died. Mm-hmm. He was like, I saw her coming and I was like, oh no, it's just a woman. And then little, like to my surprise, here we go. She here has us go. Back on the boat and into her house. Like
while she's shortly, sick.
While she's sick.
Oh my gosh.
This is her first technical documented rescue because it involved military people. The soldiers go around town and collect money for her, totaling $218, which is like half of her dad's salary for the year.
That's crazy.
They get her a military gold watch and chain to thank her. And there's a parade that was held in Newport on Independence Day, 4th of July, of course. And they follow the parade by presenting her with a brand new sleek mahogany rowboat with red velvet cushions, gold braided like whales around the edges. It's beautiful. Gosh. Of course, she liked her boat better, but it was a nice gesture.
That's very nice.
You know, Ida liked the boat. So then after this, a reporter from New York comes, and the reporter sends out news, brings up a sketch artist to illustrate her, and it's released all over the country that this small 5'3 woman rescued these military soldiers from the churning waters. Her fame is spreading quickly. It's now 1869, and not only is New York writing about it, but Harper's Weekly and Leslie's Magazine, and the publications start to become a little degrading. Like, is it womanly to row a boat? Is being a brave woman unfeminine? And one article comes out about how she should be safely married by now. And it's like really sad to her. But then there was another one that dubbed her Grace Darling of America, which there is a lighthouse worker who helped her dad named Grace Darling. She was British. And we think this was really touching to Ida because after Ida's death, there was a framed picture of Grace Darling on her wall. So like, I think she like looked up to the fact that there was another female guarding a lighthouse. So that's sweet.
I mean, imagine being the only person in the world
that has your job. That has your job.
It's got to be very isolating because it is such a specific job. And it's not just like, oh yeah, I'm the only female like in Connecticut that does this one thing, but there are people in other states that do it. This is so specific and it's so dangerous and high stakes and physical that like, yeah, I can't imagine me the only person in the world. And then to find out there's one other one.
And you're like, yay! And this is so also like Ginger Rogers because she's doing it, but in a dress. In a Victorian dress with her hair put up in a low bun, tucked back. She did everything proper. You know?
It's so crazy.
The news is covering her constantly. They offer her, hey, let's go on the road. You can do a speaking tour. You can this, you can do that. And she's like, I just want to do my job. And
I'm working.
I like this. I have things to do. I'm taking care of my entire family.
Yeah.
And when questioned about saving people's lives, she says, well, anyone would do it. And the answer is no, they wouldn't.
No.
I would see people in the harbor and I'd be like, oh no, are you okay? Like, there's no chance I'm rowing a boat out in like choppy nighttime water to save people.
Yeah.
I don't have the guts, the experience, the ability, none of it.
I did have to get ski patrol for someone who had crashed on the mountain one time.
Wow.
He was like crashed on the side and I like went to him and he's like, can you please go get help? He's like, I'm really injured. And I was like, yes. And then I was like, I am the wrong person for this because then I was panicked. So I kept falling.
And you're like, this is going to take me forever.
I'm like, this is going to take me a really long time.
You should like slide down a fast gear. Like, this guy needs ski patrol. Why doesn't everybody have like a flare? I feel like that would be dangerous.
Because teenage boys cannot be trusted. And that is mainly who is snowboarding.
Sure. 100%. she just, when the news starts coming out, she just becomes an American celebrity. She becomes friends with the Astors and the Vanderbilts who come to visit her on Lime Rock. She's part of society. She's having tea parties. She doesn't really go to their house, but they come to her house. During her lifetime, Lewis ended up being called the bravest woman in America. Ulysses S. Grant came to visit her. Members of the women's suffrage movement, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, came to visit her. And so Susan B. Anthony, she says, Miss Anthony just went on and on talking all day. She's like, I will not invite her here again. She like, but can you imagine? Susan B. Anthony is so excited because she's like, you are the example that a woman is actually doing what a man can do. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what we need to show everybody.
It's like a scientist finding like the missing link.
Right.
Like, oh my gosh. This is what I've been theorizing about.
Right. Susan B. Anthony is like taken aback. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton is probably like, stop fangirling. Like, please calm down.
Calm down. You're going to scare her.
And she did. There, I just imagine Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony's dynamic being so insane. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I pictured a lot like me and Claire.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
Like, Claire would constantly, Allie, calm down. But then somebody told her, I don't know if I showed you this text. Somebody told her, like, oh, yeah, if she comes to this thing, make sure she keeps her wine in her glass this time. And she goes,
whoa.
Nobody tells Allie what to do. And I was like, hell yeah, Claire.
Good. Also, rude.
I will spill. It's not your home. Come on. It was, we were like at an event space. Yeah. It was Bordy Vineyards. It's grass.
It's outside grass. That's annoying.
I will spill all the wine I want because it is the fruit of the soil.
You know who I don't want to hang out with? That person.
Yeah. Yeah. Principal at Falston.
It's also like, how dare you say something like that to me about my best friend? Right. Do you think I'm just going to be like, yeah, fuck Allie, you're right. Like, what?
Excuse me? Nobody tells Allie what to do is the best answer I've ever heard. Exactly. Thank you, Claire. Appreciate you. Okay. So her dad is coming to a close, right? And before his death, he amused himself by counting how many people would come to the island to see Ida. And he said that one time over 1,000 people came to see her in a day.
Wow.
I meant over 100. But in the summer, one summer, 9,000 people came to see Ida and just watch her.
Oh my gosh.
She's so famous.
She's stimulating the local economy.
She really is. She also is stimulating her own economy because she got gifts, she got letters, and even multiple marriage proposals.
Wow.
Hundreds of marriage proposals. In fact, one dad came and was like, my son goes to West Point. Here's a letter of recommendation. Like, will you marry my son? Because she's also like pretty cute.
I looked up a picture of her. She's very cute.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She's cute. She's petite. She's like a tough girl.
Yep.
She does marry eventually, and she moves in with him in 1870. The guy's name is Captain William Wilson, but they separate after 2 years, and she returns to the lighthouse. She spent most of her career alone there. I mean, it was stressful for her not being at the lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I can imagine how crazy it would be to move to a traditional role as a wife in Rhode Island. She never divorces.
Okay.
They remain married the rest of her life, but they are not together.
Okay.
Ida and her mother attended Lime Rock for her father from 1857 to 1873 when he dies. Her mom then is technically on the paperwork as the keeper, but not like officially appointed. Mm-hmm. But by 1877, her mom's health is failing and Ida had increased lighthouse keeping and caregiving responsibilities for the family. Officially, she saved 18 lives, but most people say it was closer to 30 or 35. Wow. They just didn't record them all. Mm-hmm. In when her mom dies of cancer in 1878, Ida is finally appointed as the keeper of the lighthouse. And this is largely due to a man named General Burnside. He was a Civil War hero. He became the governor of Rhode Island and then a state senator. And he's like, why does she not have the title? Like, why do we just have to keep it on the book that it's her dad? Like, it makes no sense. Yeah. This woman deserves to have it, et cetera, et cetera. And she becomes like the first woman to be officially a lighthouse keeper in the country.
That's incredible.
And he ends up helping her negotiate a salary of $750 a year.
Wow.
Which is more than $200 more than her dad.
Yeah.
And she actually was, at that point, the highest paid lighthouse keeper in the nation.
Wow, look at her.
A woman with the highest paid job. It was said of her time in the lighthouse that she could outrow any man. She could maneuver her boat better than anyone. And she could go through the waters easily to the mainland. She slept on the second floor with her bed facing the light. She woke every half hour on the half hour to make sure that it was shining into the night. Mm. She was awarded in 1881 a rare gold life-saving medal from the U.S. government, which is like a very high civilian award. Mm-hmm. It's like the highest they can give you. It's almost like a military award, but for a civilian, mm-hmm. for saving those two soldiers. When, not those two, another two who mm-hmm. were walking across the ice and fell through. Mm. And she had to go out with a rope. I think she took the clothesline.
Oh my gosh.
Out. And then they were pulling on it. So she fell through. So then she had to get out of the ice and then pull them out of the ice. Psychotic.
I've always had a fear of that. Like mm-hmm. that feeling of like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. I can't find the hole.
Yeah.
Like, where is it?
Where is it? Oh, and you're gosh. Pounding and like looking up and it's like, there's this guy. She made her last recorded rescue when she was 63 years old.
Oh my gosh, 63. Uh-huh.
Her friends were rowing out to her at the lighthouse and they kind of like stood up on the boat and like lost balance. And Ida had to row out and save her friends who were just coming for tea. Ida died of a stroke a few years later, October 24th, 1911, at the age of 69. This was 6 years after the rescue that I just talked about. Mm-hmm. Her brother found her. She had been going out to get wood to bring into the lighthouse and had like a stroke. She wasn't dead when he found her. So he gets to the mainland, gets a doctor, brings a doctor back. But mm-hmm. by that point, she was kind of in a coma inside. And when they declare her dead, Newport Harbor tolls the bells for her at night. The flags are all put at half staff, which is not something we do for civilians. Mm-hmm. More, they laid her in state.
Wow.
In Rhode Island, not in the DC, but yeah. in Rhode Island, which is again not something they do for civilians. And 1,400 people came to the church to see Ida and pay their respects for everything she had done for their town. She was buried in a community graveyard in a prominent location on top of a hill. And the grave has an anchor and a lighthouse, and everybody can see it because wow. it's on this hill, just like you would with a lighthouse. In 1880, they restructure the lighthouse. There's a lot of changing done. There's paperwork, you know, because lighthouses aren't oil really anymore. Mm-hmm. Things are changing to electricity. But Rhode Island decided, let's change the name of this island. And let's change it to be named after her. And again, this is the only lighthouse island in the entire country that is named after its keeper.
Wow.
The only one. And now it is a yacht club, the island, but they kept the name, the Ida Lewis wow. Yacht Club. And their flag has a symbol with 18 stars for the 18 people she officially saved.
Wow.
In 1995, the U.S. Coast Guard names their new first-class buoy tenders, Ida. In 2017, a Google Doodle commemorated her 175th birthday. In 2018, Ida became the first woman with a road named after her in Arlington National Cemetery.
Wow.
The U.S. Coast Guard had a poem about her on the website, which, as we know, are currently being removed. I couldn't find it.
What?
Yeah, I couldn't find it. All of the items said that there was a National Guard poem, but we know that the U.S. government is removing all of those. And then, of course, there is the documentary I watched that came out from PBS called America's Forgotten Heroine.
Well, and that's about to be gone, too.
I could barely find that one.
So losing funding.
Only on DVD. I think young girls today... Her story is so iconic that it's, like, not dated.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's dated in any way. No. Like, I think young girls today can still look up to her. And some people do say that her spirit still haunts Lime Rock, which is now called Ida Lewis Rock, or Ida Lewis Yacht Club, whatever it's called now. But I think whether she's haunting the island figuratively or literally, I think she's just somebody we can look to be like, it's not weird for girls to be able to do stuff. Yeah. We just didn't have the chances.
Exactly.
And that's Ida's really, really cool story.
I love her.
I know. She's really cool.
Oh, well, I think now we need to talk about these two ladies together in a segment we like to call Just the Two of Us. Two girls just working with their dads.
I totally left my notes out in the kitchen.
Oh, go do it.
I can wing it if you want me to.
I don't care.
No, I'm not going to do that.
No, you don't like that. Okay. So these girls are working with their dads, which I think is very cute. I love that Bella worked in the store and Ida obviously worked in the lighthouse, you know, and I just like, I feel like they were acting like sons.
It's such a common theme on this show.
100%.
That when dads are putting their energy into their daughters are more successful because I think the daughters are given more patriarchal energy, like accidentally. I don't think it's on purpose. Mm-hmm. I think like the patriarchy gets in people's heads, everyone's heads, women, men, sons, daughters. And like when your dad is working with you, it just some of his like confidence maybe that you can work the system.
And it's interesting because both of us with multiple siblings have experienced this.
And work with our dads.
Yes.
Like, I worked with my dad longer than any of my siblings, and you currently work with your dad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just, like, I love the energy that that brings into a woman. I think it's just, I think it's very interesting.
Makes you tough.
Yes, I think it does, 100%. And both of these women were extremely tough.
Mm-hmm. I like that both the women were competitive. It didn't necessarily say that Ida was competitive, but you don't get known as the best rower in town by never being like, bet I could beat you in a race. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, she 100%.
Definitely was competing with the boys, and it sounds like that's what Bella was doing too, and people were frustrated by it because she was a girl.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that, like, you know, we talked about it being kind of lonesome and, you know, and like people, when you're the only woman doing something, like she was one of the only women in Congress. Yeah. So it's like, it can be extremely isolating. And I didn't talk about this, but I think her daughter mentioned that, like, Bella got really sad later on because she was like, you know, it hurts when, like, I'm trying to do really important things and the reporters are focusing on my weight.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make me feel good. Right. And none of the other people in Congress are getting this treatment.
Right.
It's just me. No other lighthouse keeper is being like, when did they get married? It's like, it's like a trope of the job that it's like a single man on a rock.
Exactly.
Like, why is it so weird that, like, I'm not married yet?
Yeah, and it's like, I also, like, I don't necessarily think this is always the fault of the news. They know what's going to sell articles.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of them go against what they ethically believe to write a story that's going to sell.
Oh,
and
for
that
sure.
Sucks because they also have to make their name in, like, what's going on in the world. But when you are a woman doing a job that is primarily, you know, centered around men, people question, are you comfortable not being married? Are you comfortable with the way you look? Are you comfortable with people thinking that you're too this or too that or not enough this?
Right.
Because I don't have that issue as a teacher because I'm supposed to do this job.
Mm-hmm. But it's the thing. It's like, is what they're doing unfeminine? Are you breaking the rules of, you know, what it means to be a woman? You know, and it's like this whole conversation that is so tiresome. And it's so regressive.
It's exhausting.
It's exhausting. Because these are just spitfire women who want to do their jobs, to be clear.
I just want to go to work.
That is what they want to do. They want to go to work. They want to do good. They want to save people. Because, like, I like that we have, like, this, like, kind of, like, set number of, like, Ida saved this many lives on paper and then this many lives, like, off paper. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very concrete. Whereas, like, when you think about someone who is making really big, important laws, I don't know how many lives were saved, how many women were able to get out of a bad domestic situation because suddenly they could get a credit card, they could get a bank account in their name, like they could do things that they couldn't do beforehand. And I think about the lives lost in both of their stories that still haunted them, you know, like that 14-year-old boy, I'm sure Ida thought about him all the time.
Why couldn't I get to him?
And I think about that man that was sentenced to death that she spent 4 years of her life defending, and it haunted her, you know? And I just, I think that that's one of the reasons that I think it's important to have like women in careers like this, because like they do feel, you know, not that men don't feel, but like, you know, it's like, I think you need to have some emotion behind it. I think Ida had to care whether these people live or die, you know?
I think too, it is telling about what was happening in America to say that the women went from the bravest woman in America to the most dangerous woman in America.
For sure.
Like being brave right after the Civil War, like a lot of these soldiers remembered the nurses on the battlefields. Mm-hmm. They remembered what these women did. Mm-hmm. So like to see Ida in a lighthouse, the president is going to visit her and be like, you are awesome.
Yeah.
But to see Bella, the president is going to take away her position because she's too dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to have a woman with that much power because it threatens the system.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the individual man. And he might not even see it like that. Like, who knows if Jimmy Carter saw it like that or if he had it in his head she wasn't good at her job. Like, who knows? But it is threatening to the system to have a woman that is that great at her job.
Yeah. And I also kind of love that both of them were so, like, they kind of became these, like, American celebrities. Yeah. Like, they had very iconic looks and they, you know, like, they were becoming very famous and they were visited and, like, cohorting with other famous feminists, which I love that, like, that happened because, like,
all our good girls were in this episode.
Yes.
All our babes.
Because, like, Ida Lewis and Bella Abzug, they're not quite household names.
No.
But so many of the women in their story are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's exactly why, like, we do this show. It's like, yes, everybody knows who Gloria Steinem is. But did you also know that, like, there was someone actually in Congress, like, passing the laws that, like, they were talking about? Like, wouldn't it be cool if this happened?
Right. Somebody's got to do it.
Right.
Do
and then you have work. Ida actually out there and they're so excited because they're like, you're proving it. Like, you're proving that women can do these really difficult manual labor intensive jobs. Like, you're proving it. And it's so exciting to, like, have the people who, because you need both. You need the people that are theorizing that this is possible, that are theorizing, like, this would help women across America. And then the people that are actually, like, on the ground floor doing it. And I think Ida and Bella were literally doing the work.
And I also think that, like, specifically in Ida's story, one of the best things is she had an older brother.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, like, there's this assumption that all men are, like, tough, hardcore, like, manual labor or businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, he obviously did not shine in his dad's eyes as the person who would be good at this.
Yeah.
He didn't. Ida did.
Yeah.
And that is when you have to take gender out of it.
Yes.
And be like, there are, we are just people who are good at things. And Ida was good at this thing.
Yep. 100%.
Doesn't matter if she's a girl.
Nope. Amazing. Well,
so fun. What a fun one. I love it.
Would you like to toast? Who would you like to toast this evening?
I think I'm going to toast this and then I think we should talk about it on Patreon. I just want to toast things that are quietly feminist.
Okay.
And I don't think either Ida or Bella were trying to be quiet.
No.
About their feminism. I think they were trying to be loud, but where it sits in history is quietly feminist.
Yes.
And I love it.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
I'm going to toast the women who fight like hell. I love that her nickname was Battling Bella because I know that I'm a very conflict averse person. I don't like fighting people, and it takes a lot. It takes a lot emotionally out of you to do that over and over and over again. Constant. So to the women that do it, it's hard work.
Yeah. Hard
it
work.
Needs
Love
to be
it.
Done. Mm-hmm. All right. What are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
So as everybody on the show knows, I love reading romance and romanticy. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to, like, do some palate cleansers in between because I think I get really, like, sucked into a world where that's all I do. So I am currently reading, it's almost done, a book called Remarkably Bright Creatures.
Oh, that's been on my to want to read list. Is it, well, good?
It's now on my Audible. Amazing. So you can have it. And it is so good. I also, can I actually promo two books at the same time?
Yes, obviously. Okay.
I read Remarkably Bright Creatures, mm-hmm. and I read Vera Wong's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers.
Oh, I just, that's on my Libby, it's on hold.
Girl, they're both on there.
This is exciting. Okay.
Okay, so first, Vera Wong's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers is a really cute, like, older Chinese woman living in San Francisco, and she has, like, you know, her husband has passed, and she gets involved in this, like, murder mystery, which is so your cup of tea.
Yeah.
But
as soon as I saw the description of this book, I was like, that's on my
I loved it. Literally on hold. It was so good. It was so refreshing.
Yeah.
It had, I'm sure, tropes that are funnier to people of Asian descent, mm-hmm. but me having a very specific grandma living on a creek with, like, very detailed way that she does things, like, I loved, like, my grandmother had a blue stitch in the corner of her tablecloths to know which corner it went off of. So, like, she didn't want it turned around, even though it was just a rectangle. She wanted it a specific way.
That's so smart.
I know. So that's, it's crazy. Anyway, the other one, Remarkably Bright Creatures, I definitely suggest the audiobook because the person voicing the octopus's subconscious is so good.
Okay.
But this one is just about, an aging woman interacting with young people. Both books are very similar. I guess that's why they suggested them. Mm-hmm. But she, like, works at an aquarium and is, like, building a relationship with this remarkably bright creature as, like, a background story, like the B story.
Yeah.
You know, the A story is obviously with the people. But, mm-hmm. again, it's a mystery kind of. Yeah. I don't know. I'm feeling really good about it. I don't get, like, sucked in the same way I do with romances. Mm-hmm. And I definitely don't think romance novels are the lesser art.
No.
Like, I don't believe that at all. Mm-mm. I was like, I need something new for a little bit.
Yeah.
So I've been really trying to, like, ask my friends at school for, like, book suggestions. And they've been helping out.
I love that. Mine is also a book.
Oh, yay. You guys have so much to read now. And you don't have access to my Audible. So that's psychotic.
So I read a book by Josie Silver a while ago. I promoted it. This is called One Night in December. Night in December, whatever. This one was called One Night on the Island. And I'm going to promote, like, it in two ways. Number one, I thought the story was great because it was about a young woman. She's turning 30 and she writes a column all about her love life and trying to find her perfect match, her flamingo, her life partner.
Right.
And she's like, well, I'm 30 and I've been writing this article, this column for a decade or whatever. And she's like, and I haven't found him yet. So she goes to this island to marry herself. And so there's, like, this internal, like, there's obviously a love story on the island as well, but then it's, like, about her love story with herself. And Josie Silver does a great job of, like, I'm, like, listening to it. I'm like, how was this going to work out? How? Because, like, the stakes are so high for both of them, you know, to not be together. And I don't know. It's just, like, it's lovely. And the audiobook is great because it's an American and a British woman. And can I tell you, I like it because the two voice actors don't try to do each other's accents.
Good. That's rough.
And they don't try and speak in a feminine voice. Like, I hate it.
I like hot chocolate. You know what TikTok I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It's one of my big pet peeves in audiobooks. I'm like, just continue reading, please.
Just, like, read it your way.
If you're not the guy who's doing the Harry Potter books, I can't remember his name right now, but it's like, if you're not him, mm-hmm. don't do the voices.
Don't be him.
It bothers me.
Harry! Yeah. His Hermione voice is psychotic. Psychotic, Katie.
But, like, he does so many. But, like, it gives me the ick when it's a guy that's like, George, did you take out the trash? or a woman that's like,
George.
Hey, baby.
Yeah, that's crazy. I agree.
I don't like it.
It's psychopathic.
So they don't try and do each other's accents. They don't try and do each other's voices. It's lovely. And, yeah, I like Josie Silver's books, right?
That
I'm liking her books.
You. That would. It would.
All right. Fun. Well, thank you all for listening. We can't wait to see you again next week for another episode. If you want to hang out with us more, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. You can support the show emotionally, financially, mostly financially. But if you want, if you prefer an emotional support, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That goes so far for us, and it means a ton, especially in this crowded podcast space right now. So yeah, follow us everywhere. Join us for Tipsy Tuesdays every week, and
which is tomorrow.
And join us every day for Allie's amazing facts that she posts. It's a great, the Hearst on the Rocks Instagram is wonderful. But yeah, and if not, we'll just see you again next week. But we want you to never forget that well-behaved women
do not have their own credit cards.
No, and crazy. They rarely make history.
Goodbye. You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.